Penguin Audio presents Christine by Stephen King. Read by Holter Graham. This is for George Romero and Chris Forrest Romero and the Berg. Christine. Prologue. This is the story of a lover's triangle, I suppose you'd say. Arnie Cunningham, Lee Cabot, and, of course, Christine. But I want you to understand that Christine was there first. She was Arnie's first love, and while I wouldn't presume to say for sure, not from whatever heights of wisdom I've attained in my 22 years anyway, I think she was his only true love. So I call what happened a tragedy. Arnie and I grew up on the same block together, went to Owen Andrews Grammar School and Darby Junior High together, then to Libertyville High together. I guess I was the main reason Arnie didn't just get gobbled up in high school. I was a big guy there. Yeah, I know, that doesn't mean donkey shit. 5 years after you've graduated, you can't even catch a free beer on having been captain of the football and baseball teams and an all-conference swimmer. But because I was, Arnie at least never got killed. He took a lot of abuse, but he never got killed. He was a loser, you know? Every high school has to have at least two. It's like a national law. One male, one female. Everyone's dumping ground. Having a bad day, flunked a big test, had an argument with your folks, and got grounded for the weekend? No problem. Just find one of those poor, sad sacks that go scurrying around the halls like criminals before the homeroom bell and walk it right to him. And sometimes they do get killed. In every important way except the physical. Sometimes they find something to hold on to and they survive. Arnie had me. And then he had Christine. Lee came later. I just wanted you to understand that. Arnie was a natural out. He was out with the jocks because he was scrawny, 5'10", and about 140 pounds soaking wet in all his clothes plus a pair of desert driver boots. He was out with the high school intellectuals, a pretty out group themselves in a burg like Libertyville, because he had no specialty. Arnie was smart, but his brains didn't go naturally to any one thing, unless it was automotive mechanics. He was great at that stuff. When it came to cars, the kid was some kind of a goofy born natural. But his parents, who both taught at the university in Horlicks, could not see their son, who had scored in the top 5% on his Stanford Binet, taking the shop courses. He was lucky they let him take Auto Shop 1, 2, and 3. He had to battle his butt off to get that. He was out with the druggies because he didn't do dope. He was out with the macho pegged jeans and Lucky Strikes group because he didn't do booze, and if you hit him hard enough, he'd cry. Oh, yes, and he was out with the girls. His glandular machinery had gone totally bananas. I mean, Arnie was Pimple City. He washed his face maybe 5 times a day, took maybe 2 dozen showers a week, and tried every cream and nostrum known to modern science. None of it did any good. Arnie's face looked like a loaded pizza, and he was going to have one of those pitted, poxy faces forever. I liked him just the same. He had a quirky sense of humor and a mind that never stopped asking questions, playing games and doing funky little calisthenics. It was Arnie who showed me how to make an ant farm when I was 7, and we spent just about one whole summer watching those little buggers, fascinated by their industry and their deadly seriousness. It was Arnie's suggestion when we were 10 that we sneak out one night and put a load of dried horse apples from the Route 17 stables under the gross plastic horse on the lawn of the Libertyville Motel, just over the line in Monroeville. Arnie knew about chess first. He knew about poker first. He showed me how to maximize my Scrabble score. On rainy days, right up until the time I fell in love, well, sort of. She was a cheerleader with a fantastic body, and I sure was in love with that. Although when Arnie pointed out that her mind had all the depth and resonance of a Sean Cassidy 45, I couldn't really tell him he was full of shit, because he wasn't. It was Arnie I thought of first, because Arnie knew how to maximize rainy days, just like he knew how to maximize Scrabble scores. Maybe that's one of the ways you recognize really lonely people. They can always think of something neat to do on rainy days. You can always call them up. They're always home. Fucking always. For my part, I taught him how to swim. I worked out with him and got him to eat his green vegetables so he could build up that scrawny bod a little. I got him a job on a road crew the year before our senior year at Libertyville High, and for that one, we both battled our butts off with his parents, who saw themselves as great friends of the farm workers in California and the steel workers in the burg, but who were horrified at the idea of their gifted son, top 5% on his Stanford-Binet, remember, getting his wrists dirty and his neck red. Then, near the end of that summer vacation, Arnie saw Christine for the first time and fell in love with her. I was with him that day. We were on our way home from work, and I would testify on the matter before the throne of Almighty God if called upon to do so. Brother, he fell, and he fell hard. It could have been funny if it hadn't been so sad, and if it hadn't gotten scary as quick as it did. It could have been funny if it hadn't been so bad. How bad was it? It was bad from the start, and it got worse in a hurry. Epilogue. I guess if this was a made-up story, I would end it by telling you how the broken-legged knight of Darnell's garage wooed and won the lady fair, she of the pink nylon scarf and the arrogant Nordic cheekbones. But that never happened. Lee Cabot is Lee Ackerman now. She's in Taos, New Mexico, married to an IBM customer service rep. She sells Amway in her spare time. She has two little girls, identical twins, so I guess she probably doesn't have all that much spare time. I keep up on her doings after a fashion. My affection for the lady never really faded. We trade cards at Christmas, and I also send her a card on her birthday because she never forgets mine. That sort of thing. There are times when it seems a lot longer than 4 years. What happened to us? I don't really know. We went together for 2 years. Slept together very satisfactorily, went to school together, drew, and were friends with each other. Her father shut up about our crazy story after my father talked with him, although he always regarded me after that as something of a dubious person. I think that both he and Mrs. Cabot were relieved when Lee and I went our separate ways. I could feel it when we started to drift apart, and it hurt me. It hurt a lot. I craved her in a way you continue to crave some substance on which you have no more physical dependency. Candy, tobacco, Coca-Cola. I carried a torch for her. But I'm afraid I carried it self-consciously and dropped it with an almost unseemly haste. And maybe I do know what happened. What happened that night in Darnell's garage was a secret between us. And of course, lovers need their secrets. But this wasn't a good one to have. It was something cold and unnatural, something that smacked of madness and worse than madness. It smacked of the grave. There were nights after love when we would lie together in bed, naked, belly to belly, and that thing would be between us. Roland D. LeBay's face. I would be kissing her mouth, or her breasts, or her belly, warm with rising passion, and I would suddenly hear his voice. That's about the finest smell in the world, except for pussy. And I would freeze, my passion all steam and ashes. There were times, God knows, when I could see it in her face as well. The lovers don't always live happily ever after, even when they've done what seemed right as well as they could do it. That's something else it took 4 years to learn. So we drifted apart. A secret needs two faces to bounce between. A secret needs to see itself in another pair of eyes. And although I did love her, all the kisses, all the endearments, all the walks arm in arm through blowing October leaves, none of those things could quite measure up to that magnificently simple act of tying her scarf around my arm. Lee left college to be married, and then it was goodbye Drew and hello Taos. I went to her wedding with hardly a qualm. Nice fellow. Drove a Honda Civic. No problems there. I never had to worry about making the football squad, Drew doesn't even have a football squad. Instead, I took an extra class each semester and went to summer school for 2 years, in the time when I would have been sweating under the August sun, hitting the tackling dummies, if things had happened differently. As a result, I graduated early. 3 semesters early, in fact. If you met me on the street, you wouldn't notice a limp. But if you walked with me 4 or 5 miles, I do at least 3 miles every day as a matter of course. That physical therapy stuff sticks. You'd notice me starting to pull to the right a little bit. My left leg aches on rainy days. And on snowy nights. And sometimes when I have my nightmares, they're not so frequent now, I wake up, sweating and clutching at that leg, where there is still a hard bulge of flesh above the knee. But all my worries about wheelchairs, braces, and built-up heels proved thankfully hollow. And I never liked football that well anyway. Michael, Regina, and Arnie Cunningham were buried in a family plot in the Libertyville Heights Cemetery. No one went out to the gravesite but members of the family, Regina's people from Ligonier, some of Michael's people from New Hampshire and New York, a few others. The funeral was 5 days after that final hellish scene in the garage. The coffins were closed. The very fact of those 3 wooden boxes, lined up on a triple bier like soldiers, struck my heart like a shovel full of cold earth. The memory of the ant farms couldn't stand against the mute testimony of those boxes. I cried a little. Afterward, I rolled myself down the aisle toward them and put my hand tentatively on the one in the center, not knowing if it was Arnie's or not, not caring. I stayed that way for quite a while, head down, and then a voice said behind me, "Wanna push back out to the vestry, Dennis?" I craned my neck around. It was Mercer, looking neat and lawyerly in a dark wool suit. "Sure," I said. "Just give me a couple of seconds, okay?"
"Fine."
I hesitated and then said, "The papers say Michael was killed at home, that the car rolled over him after he slipped on the ice or something."
"Yes," he said.
"You are doing?"
Mercer hesitated. "It makes things simpler."
His gaze shifted to where Lee was standing with my folks. She was talking with my mother, but looking anxiously toward me.
"Pretty girl," he said.
He had said it before, in the hospital.
"I'm gonna marry her someday," I said.
"I wouldn't be surprised if you did,"
Mercer replied.
"Did anyone ever tell you that you got the balls of a tiger?"
"I think Coach Puffer did," I said,
"once."
He laughed.
"You ready for that push, Dennis? You've been down here long enough. Let it go."
"Easier said than done."
He nodded.
"Yeah, I guess so."
"Will you tell me one thing?" I asked. "I have to know."
"I will if I can."
I had to stop and clear my throat. "What did you do with the pieces?"
"Why, I saw to that myself," Mercer said. His voice was light, almost joking, but his face was very serious. "I had 2 fellows from the local police run all those pieces through the crusher out back at Darnell's garage. Made a little cube about so big."
He held his hands about 2 feet apart.
"One of those guys got a hell of a bad cut. Took stitches."
Mercer suddenly smiled. It was the bitterest, coldest smile I've ever seen.
"He said it bit him."
Then he pushed me up the aisle to where my family and my girl stood waiting for me. So that's my story, except for the dreams. I'm 4 years older, and Arnie's face has grown hazy to me, a browning photograph from an old yearbook. I never would have believed that could happen, but it has. I made it through, made the transition from adolescence to manhood, whatever that is, somehow. I've got a college degree on which the ink is almost dry, and I've been teaching junior high history. I started last year, and 2 of my original students, Buddy Repperton types, both of them, were older than I was. I'm single, but there are a few interesting ladies in my life, and I hardly think of Arnie at all. except in the dreams. The dreams aren't the only reason I've set all this down. There's another, which I'll tell you in a moment, but I would be lying if I said the dreams weren't a big part of the reason. Maybe it's an effort to lance the wound and clean it out, or maybe it's just that I'm not rich enough to afford a shrink. In one of the dreams, I'm back where the funeral service was held. The three coffins are on their triple bier, but the church is empty except for me. In the dream, I am on crutches again, standing at the foot of the central aisle, back by the door. I don't want to go down there, but my crutches are pulling me along, moving by themselves. I touch the middle coffin. It springs open at my touch, and lying inside the satin interior is not Arnie, but Roland D. LeBay, a putrescent corpse in an army uniform. As the bloated smell of gassy decay rushes out at me, the corpse opens its eyes, its rotting hands, black and slimy with some fungoid growth, grope upward and find my shirt before I can back away, and it pulls itself up until its glaring, reeking face is only inches from mine, and it begins to croak over and over again. Can't beat that smell, can ya? Nothing smells this good except for pussy. Except for pussy. Except for pussy. I try to scream, but I can't scream, because LeBay's hands have settled in a noxious, tightening ring around my throat. In the other dream, and this one is somehow worse, I've finished with a class or proctoring a study hall at Norton Junior High where I teach. I pack my books back into my briefcase, stuff in my papers, and leave the room for my next class. And there in the hall, packed in between the industrial gray lockers lining it, is Christine. Brand new and sparkling, sitting on four new white wall tires, a chrome winged victory hood ornament tilting toward me. She is empty, but her engine guns and falls off, guns and falls off, guns and falls off. In some of the dreams, the voice from the radio is the voice of Richie Valens, killed long ago in a plane crash with Buddy Holly and J.P. Richardson, the big bopper. Richie is screaming La Bamba to a Latin beat, and as Christine suddenly lunges toward me, laying rubber on the hall floor and tearing open locker doors on either side with her door handles, I see that there is a vanity plate on the front, a grinning white skull on a dead black field. Imprinted over the skull are the words, "Rock and roll will never die." Then I wake up, sometimes screaming, always clutching my leg. But the dreams are fewer now. Something I read in one of my psych classes, I took a lot of them, maybe hoping to understand things that can't be understood, is that people dream less as they grow older. I think I'm going to be all right now. Last Christmas season, when I sent Lee her annual card, I added a line to my usual note on the back. Below my signature, on impulse, I scribbled, "How are you dealing with it?" Then I sealed the card up and mailed it before I could change my mind. I got a postcard back a month later. It showed the new Taos Center for the Performing Arts on the front. On the back was my address and a single flat line. "Dealing with what?" L. One way or another, I guess we find out things we have to know. Around the same time, it seems as though it's around Christmas that my thoughts turn to it the most often, I dropped Rick Mercer a note, because the question had been on my mind more and more, gnawing at me. I wrote and asked him what had become of the block of scrap metal that had once been Christine. I got no answer. But time is teaching me how to deal with that, too. I think about it less. I really do. So here I am, at the tag end of everything, old memories and old nightmares all bundled into a neat sheaf of pages. Soon I will put them in a folder and put the folder in my file cabinet and lock that drawer. And that will be the end. But I told you there was something else, didn't I? Some other reason for writing it all down? His single-minded purpose. His unending fury. I read it in the paper a few weeks ago. Just an item that got put on the AP wire because it was bizarre, I suppose. "Be honest, Gilder," I can hear Arnie saying. So I will. It was that item that got me going. more than all the dreams and old memories. The news item was about a guy named Sander Galton, whose nickname, one would logically assume, must have been Sandy. This Sander Galton was killed out in California, where he was working at a drive-in movie theater in L.A. He was apparently alone, closing up shop for the night after the movie had ended. He was in the snack bar. A car ripped right through one of the walls, plowed through the counter, smashed the popcorn machine, and got him as he was trying to unlock the door to the projection booth. The cops knew that was what he was doing when the car ran him down because they found the key in his hand. I read that item, headed Bizarre Murder by Car in Los Angeles, and I thought of what Mercer had told me. That last thing. He said it bit him. Of course, it's impossible. But it was all impossible to start with. I keep thinking of George LeBay in Ohio, his sister in Colorado, Lee in New Mexico. What if it started again? What if it's working its way east, finishing the job, saving me for last? His single-minded purpose. His unending fury. This concludes the reading of Christine by Stephen King. Copyright 1983 by Stephen King. This book was read by Holter Graham. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Viking, a member of Penguin Group USA, Incorporated, and was produced in 2010 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Part 1. Dennis. Teenage Car Songs. Chapter 1. First Views. "Oh, my God!" my friend Arnie Cunningham cried out suddenly. "What is it?" I asked. His eyes were bulging from behind his steel-rimmed glasses. He had plastered one hand over his face so that his palm was partially cupping his mouth, and his neck could have been on ball bearings the way he was craning back over his shoulder. "Stop the car, Dennis! Go back!" "What are you... Go back! I want to look at her again!" Suddenly, I understood. "Oh, man, forget it," I said. "If you mean that thing we just passed, go back!" He was almost screaming. I went back, thinking that it was maybe one of Arnie's subtle little jokes. But it wasn't. He was gone, lock, stock, and barrel. Arnie had fallen in love. She was a bad joke, and what Arnie saw in her that day, I'll never know. The left side of her windshield was a snarled spiderweb of cracks. The right rear deck was bashed in, and an ugly nest of rust had grown in the paint-scraped valley. The back bumper was askew, the trunk lid was ajar, and upholstery was bleeding out through several long tears in the seat covers, both front and back. It looked as if someone had worked on the upholstery with a knife. One tire was flat. The others were bald enough to show the canvas cording. Worst of all, there was a dark puddle of oil under the engine block. Arnie had fallen in love with a 1958 Plymouth Fury, one of the long ones with the big fins. There was an old and sun-faded for sale sign propped on the right side of the windshield, the side that was not cracked. "Look at her lines, Dennis," Arnie whispered. He was running around the car like a man possessed. His sweaty hair flew and flopped. He tried the back door on the passenger side, and it came open with a scream. "Arnie, you're having me on, aren't you?" I said. "It's sunstroke, right? Tell me it's sunstroke. I'll take you home and put you under the friggin' air conditioner, and we'll forget all about this, okay?" But I said it without much hope. He knew how to joke, but there was no joke on his face then. Instead, there was a kind of goofy madness I didn't like much. He didn't even bother to reply. A hot, stuffy billow of air, redolent of age, oil, and advanced decomposition, puffed out of the open door. Arnie didn't seem to notice that either. He got in and sat down on the ripped and faded back seat. Once, 20 years before, it had been red. Now it was a faded wash pink. I reached in and pulled up a little puff of upholstery, looked at it, and blew it away. "Looks like the Russian army marched over it on their way to Berlin," I said. He finally noticed I was still there.
"Yeah, yeah, but she could be fixed up. She could be tough. A moving unit, Dennis, a beauty, a real..."
"Here, here! What are you two kids up to?"
It was an old guy. It looked as if he was enjoying, more or less, his 70th summer. Probably less. This particular dude struck me as the sort of man who enjoyed very little. His hair was long and scraggy, what little there was left of it. He had a good case of psoriasis going on the bald part of his skull. He was wearing green old man's pants and low-topped Keds. No shirt. Instead, there was something cinched around his waist that looked like a lady's corset. When he got closer, I saw it was a back brace. From the look of it, I would say, just offhand, that he had changed it last somewhere around the time Lyndon Johnson died.
"What are you kids up to?"
His voice was shrill and strident.
"Sir, is this your car?"
Arnie asked him. Not much question that it was. The Plymouth was parked on the lawn of the post-war tract house from which the old man had issued. The lawn was horrible, but it looked positively great with that Plymouth in the foreground for perspective.
"What if it is?"
the old guy demanded.
"I..."
Arnie had to swallow. "I want to buy it." The old dude's eyes gleamed. The angry look on his face was replaced by a furtive gleam in the eye and a certain hungry sneer around the lips. Then a large, resplendent, shit-eating grin appeared. That was the moment, I think. Then, just at that moment, when I felt something cold and blue inside me. There was a moment, just then, when I felt like slugging Arnie and dragging him away. Something came into the old man's eyes, not just the gleam, it was something behind the gleam.
"Well, you should have said so,"
the old guy told Arnie. He stuck out his hand, and Arnie took it.
"LeBay's the name. Roland D. LeBay, U.S. Army. Retired."
"Arnie Cunningham."
The old sport pumped his hand and sort of waved at me. I was out of the play. He had his sucker. Arnie might as well have handed LeBay his wallet.
"How much?" Arnie asked, and then he plunged ahead. "Whatever you want for it, it's not enough."
I groaned inside instead of sighing. His checkbook had just joined his wallet. For a moment, LeBay's grin faltered a little, and his eyes narrowed down suspiciously. I think he was evaluating the possibility that he was being put on. He studied Arnie's open, longing face for signs of guile, and then asked the murderously perfect question.
"Son, have you ever owned a car before?"
"He owns a Mustang Mach 2, I said quickly. "His folks bought it for him. It's got a Hurst shifter, a supercharger, and it can boil the road in first gear. It..."
"No,"
Arnie said quietly. "I just got my driver's license this spring." LeBay tipped me a brief but crafty gaze, and then swung his full attention back to his prime target. He put both hands in the small of his back and stretched. I caught a sour whiff of sweat.
"Got a back problem in the Army," he said. "Full disability. Doctors could never put it right. Anyone ever ask you what's wrong with the world, boys? You tell them it's three things. Doctors, commies, and nigger radicals. Of the three, commies is the worst, closely followed by doctors. And if they want to know who told you, tell them Roland D. LeBay. Yes, sir."
He touched the old, scuffed hood of the Plymouth with a kind of bemused love.
"This here is the best car I ever owned. Bought her in September 1957. Back then, that's when you got your new model year in September. All summer long, they'd show you pictures of cars under hoods and cars under tarps until you were fair dying to know what they look like underneath. Not like now."
His voice dripped contempt for the debased times he had lived to see.
"Brand new she was. Had the smell of a brand new car. And that's about the finest smell in the world.
he considered.
Except maybe for pussy.
I looked at Arnie, nibbling the insides of my cheeks madly to keep from braying laughter all over everything. Arnie looked back at me, astounded. The old man appeared to notice neither of us. He was off on his own planet.
I was in khaki for 34 years, LeBay told us, still touching the hood of the car. Went in at 16 in 1923. I ate dust in Texas and seen crabs as big as lobsters and some of them Nogales horde dens. I saw men with their guts coming at their ears turn big, too. In France, I saw that. Their guts was coming at their ears. You believe that, son?
Yes, sir, Arnie said. I don't think he'd heard a word LeBay said. He was shifting from foot to foot as if he had to go to the bathroom bad. About the car, though.
You go to the university? LeBay barked suddenly. Up there at Horlicks?
No, sir. I go to Libertyville High.
Good, LeBay said grimly. Steer clear of colleges. They're full of nigger lovers that want to give away the Panama Canal. Think tanks, they call them. Asshole tanks, say I.
He gazed fondly at the car, sitting on its flat tire, its paint job mellowing rustily in the late afternoon sunlight.
Hurt my back in the spring of 57, he said. Army was going to rack and ruin even then. I got out just in time. I came on back to Libertyville, looked over the rolling iron, I took my time. Then I walked into Norman Cobb's Plymouth dealership, where the bowling alley is now on Outer Main Street, and I ordered this here car. I said, you get it in red and white, next year's model. Red as a fire engine on the inside. And they did it. When I got her, she had a total of 6 miles on the odometer. Yes, sir.
He spat. I glanced over Ernie's shoulder at the odometer. The glass was cloudy, but I could read the damage all the same. 97,432.6. Jesus wept.
If you love the car so much, why are you selling it? I asked.
He turned a milky, rather frightening gaze on me.
Are you cracking wise on me, son?
I didn't answer, but I didn't drop my gaze either. After a few moments of eye-to-eye dueling, which Arnie totally ignored, he was running a slow and loving hand over one of the back fins. He said,
Can't drive anymore. Back's gotten too bad. Eyes are going the same way.
Suddenly I got it, or thought I did. If he had given us the correct dates, he was 71, and at 70 this state makes you start taking compulsory eye exams every year before they'll renew your driver's license. LeBay had either failed his eye exam or was afraid of failing. Either way, it came to the same thing. Rather than submit to that indignity, he had put the Plymouth up. And after that, the car had gotten old fast.
How much do you want for it? Arnie asked again.
Oh, he just couldn't wait to be slaughtered. LeBay turned his face up to the sky, appearing to consider it for rain. Then he looked down at Arnie again and gave him a large, kindly smile that was far too much like the previous shit-eating grin for me.
I've been asking 300, he said, but you seem a likely enough lad. I'll make it 250 for you.
Oh, my Christ, I said. But he knew who his sucker was, and he knew exactly how to drive the wedge in between us. In the words of my grandfather, he hadn't fallen off a hay truck yesterday.
Okay, he said brusquely, if that's how you want it. I got my 4:30 story to watch. Edge of night. Never miss it if I can help it. Nice chinning with you boys. So long.
Arnie threw me such a smoking look of pain and anger that I backed off a step. He went after the old man and took his elbow. They talked. I couldn't hear it all, but I could see more than enough. The old man's pride was wounded. Arnie was earnest and apologetic. The old man just hoped Arnie understood that he couldn't stand to see the car that had brought him through safe to his golden years insulted. Arnie agreed. Little by little, the old man allowed himself to be led back. And again, I felt something consciously dreadful about him. It was as if a cold November wind could think. I can't put it any better than that. If he says one more word, I wash my hands of the whole thing, LeBay said, and cocked a horny, calloused thumb at me. He won't, Arnie said hastily. 300, did you say? Yes, I believe that was 250 was the quoted price, I said loudly. Arnie looked stricken, afraid the old man would walk away again, but LeBay was taking no chances. The fish was almost out of the pond now. 250 would do it, I guess, LeBay allowed. He glanced my way again, and I saw that we had an understanding. He didn't like me, and I didn't like him. To my ever-increasing horror, Arnie pulled his wallet out and began thumbing through it. There was silence among the three of us. LeBay looked on. I looked away at a little kid who was trying to kill himself on a puke-green skateboard. Somewhere a dog barked. Two girls who looked like eighth or ninth graders went past, giggling and holding clutches of library books to their blooming chests. I had only one hope left for getting Arnie out of this. It was the day before payday. Given time, even 24 hours, this wild fever might pass. Arnie was beginning to remind me of Toad Hall. When I looked back, Arnie and LeBay were looking at 2 fives and 6 ones. All that had been in his wallet, apparently. How about a check? Arnie asked. LeBay offered Arnie a dry smile and said nothing. It's a good check, Arnie protested. It would be, too. We had been working all summer for Carson Brothers on the I-376 extension, the one which natives of the Pittsburgh area firmly believe will never be really finished. Arnie sometimes declared that PennDOT had begun taking bids on the I-376 work shortly after the Civil War ended. Not that either of us had any right to complain. A lot of kids were either working for slave wages that summer or not working at all. We were making good money, even clocking some overtime. Brad Jeffries, the job foreman, had been frankly dubious about taking a kid like Arnie on, but had finally allowed that he could use a flagman. The girl he had been planning to hire had gotten herself pregnant and had run off to get married. So Arnie had started off flagging in June, but had gotten into the harder work little by little, running mostly on guts and determination. It was the first real job he'd ever had, and he didn't want to screw it up. Brad was reasonably impressed, and the summer sun had even helped Arnie's erupting complexion a little. Maybe it was the ultraviolet.
I'm sure it's a good check, son, LeBay said. But I gotta make a cash deal, you understand.
I didn't know if Arnie understood, but I did. It would be too easy to stop payment on a local check if this rust bucket Plymouth threw a rod or blew a piston on the way home.
You can call the bank, Arnie said, starting to sound desperate.
Nope,
LeBay said, scratching his armpit above the scabrous brace.
It's going on 5:30. Bank's long since closed.
A deposit, then,
Arnie said, and held out the $16. He looked positively wild. It may be that you're having trouble believing a kid who was almost old enough to vote could have gotten himself so worked up over an anonymous old clunk in the space of 15 minutes. I was having some trouble believing it myself. Only Roland D. LeBay seemed not to be having trouble with it, and I supposed it was because at his age he had seen everything. It was only later that I came to believe that his odd sureness might come from other sources. Either way, if any milk of human kindness had ever run in his veins, it had curdled to sour cream long ago.
I'd have to have at least 10% down,
LeBay said. The fish was out of the water. In a moment, it would be netted.
If I had 10%, I'd hold her for 24 hours.
Dennis, Arnie said, can you loan me $9 until tomorrow?
I had 12 in my own wallet, and no particular place to go. Day after day of spreading sand and digging trenches for culverts had done wonders when it came to getting ready for football practice, but I had no social life at all. Lately, I hadn't even been assaulting the ramparts of my cheerleader girlfriend's body in the style to which she had become accustomed. I was rich, but lonely. Come on over here and let's see, I said. LeBay's brow darkened, but he could see he was stuck with my input, like it or not. His frizzy white hair blew back and forth in the mild breeze. He kept one hand possessively on the Plymouth's hood. Arnie and I walked back toward where my car, a 75 Duster, was parked at the curb. I put an arm around Arnie's shoulders. For some reason, I remembered the two of us up in his room on a rainy fall day when we were both no more than 6 years old, cartoons flickering on an ancient black-and-white TV as we colored with old Crayolas from a dented coffee can. The image made me feel sad and a little scared. I have days, you know, when it seems to me that 6 is an optimum age, and that's why it only lasts about 7.2 seconds in real time. "Have you got it, Dennis? I'll get it back to you tomorrow afternoon." "Yeah, I've got it," I said. "But what in God's name are you doing, Arnie? That old fart has got total disability, for Christ's sake. He doesn't need the money, and you're not a charitable institution." "I don't get it. What are you talking about?" "He's screwing you. He's screwing you for the simple pleasure of it. If he took that car to Darnell's, he couldn't get $50 for parts. It's a piece of shit." "No, no, it isn't." Without the bad complexion, my friend Arnie would have looked completely ordinary. But God gives everyone at least one good feature, I think, and with Arnie, it was his eyes. Behind the glasses that usually obscured them, they were a fine and intelligent gray, the color of clouds on an overcast autumn day. They could be almost uncomfortably sharp and probing when something was going on that he was interested in. But now, they were distant and dreaming.
"It's not a piece of shit at all."
That was when I really began to understand it was more than just Arnie suddenly deciding he wanted a car. He had never expressed an interest in owning one before. He was content to ride with me and chip in for gas or to pedal his 3-speed. And it wasn't as if he needed a car so he could step out. To the best of my knowledge, Arnie had never had a date in his life. This was something different. It was love, or something like it. I said, "At least get him to start it for you, Arnie, and get the hood up. There's a puddle of oil underneath. I think the block might be cracked. I really think... Can you loan me the 9? His eyes were fixed on mine. I gave up. I took out my wallet and gave him the $9. "Thanks, Dennis," he said. "Your funeral, man." He took no notice. He put my 9 with his 16 and went back to where LeBay stood by the car. He handed the money over, and LeBay counted it carefully, wetting his thumb. "I'll only hold it for 24 hours, you understand," LeBay said.
"Yes, sir, that'll be fine," Arnie said.
"I'll just go in the house and write you out a receipt," he said. "What did you say your name was, soldier?"
Arnie smiled a little.
"Cunningham. Arnold Cunningham."
LeBay grunted and walked across his unhealthy lawn to his back door. The outer door was one of those funky aluminum combination doors with a scrolled letter in the center, a big L in this case. The door slammed behind him.
"The guy's weird, Arnie. The guy's really fucking
But Arnie wasn't there. He was sitting behind the wheel of the car. That same sappy expression was on his face. I went around to the front and found the hood release. I pulled it, and the hood went up with a rusty scream that made me think of the sound effects you hear on some of those haunted house records. Flecks of metal sifted down. The battery was an old Allstate, and the terminals were so glooped up with green corrosion that you couldn't tell which was positive and which was negative. I pulled the air cleaner and looked glumly into a 4-barrel carb as black as a mine shaft. I lowered the hood and went back to where Arnie was sitting, running his hand along the edge of the dashboard over the speedometer, which was calibrated up to an utterly absurd 120 miles per hour. Had cars ever really gone that fast? "Arnie, I think the engine blocks cracked. I really do. This car is lunch, my friend. It's just total lunch. If you want wheels, we can find you something a lot better than this for $250. I mean it, a lot better."
"It's 20 years old," he said. "Do you realize a car is officially an antique when it's 20 years old?
"Yeah," I said. "The junkyard behind Darnell's is full of official antiques, you know what I mean?"
"Dennis."
The door banged. LeBay was coming back. It was just as well. Further discussion would have been meaningless. I may not be the world's most sensitive human being, but when the signals are strong enough, I can pick them up. This was something Arnie felt he had to have, and I wasn't going to talk him out of it. I didn't think anyone was going to talk him out of it. LeBay handed him the receipt with a flourish, written on a plain sheet of notepaper in an old man's spidery and slightly trembling script, was received from Arnold Cunningham, $25 as a 24-hour deposit on 1958 Plymouth, Christine. And below that, he had signed his name. "What's this, Christine?" I asked, thinking I might have misread it, or he might have misspelled it. His lips tightened, and his shoulders went up a little, as if he expected to be laughed at, or as if he were daring me to laugh at him.
"Christine," he said, "is what I always called her."
"Christine," Arnie said. "I like it. Don't you, Dennis?"
Now he was talking about naming the damn thing. It was all getting to be a bit much.
"What do you think, Dennis? Do you like it?"
"No," I said. "If you gotta name it, Arnie, why don't you name it Trouble?" He looked hurt at that, but I was beyond caring. I went back to my car to wait for him, wishing I'd taken a different route home. Chapter 2. The First Argument. I drove Arnie to his house and went in with him to have a piece of cake and a glass of milk before going home. It was a decision I repented very quickly. Arnie lived on Laurel Street, which is in a quiet residential neighborhood on the west side of Libertyville. As far as that goes, most of Libertyville is quiet and residential. It isn't ritzy like the neighboring suburb of Fox Chapel, where most of the homes are estates, like the ones you used to see every week on Columbo. But it isn't like Monroeville either, with its miles of malls, discount tire warehouses, and dirty book emporiums. There isn't any heavy industry. It's mostly a bedroom community for the nearby university. Not ritzy, but sort of brainy, at least. Arnie had been quiet and contemplative all the way home. I tried to draw him out, but he wouldn't be drawn. I asked him what he was going to do with the car. "Fix it up," he said absently, and lapsed back into silence. Well, he had the ability. I wasn't questioning that. He was good with tools. He could listen. He could isolate. His hands were sensitive and quick with machinery. It was only when he was around other people, particularly girls, that they got clumsy and restless, wanting to crack knuckles or jam themselves in his pockets or, worst of all, wander up to his face and run over the scorched earth landscape of his cheeks and chin and forehead, drawing attention to it. He could fix the car up, but the money he had earned that summer was earmarked for college. He had never owned a car before, and I didn't think he had any idea of the sinister way that old cars can suck money. They suck it the way a vampire is supposed to suck blood. He could avoid labor costs in most cases by doing the work himself, but the parts alone would half-buck him to death before he was through. I said some of these things to him, but they just rolled off. His eyes were still distant, dreaming. I could not have told you what he was thinking. Both Michael and Regina Cunningham were at home. She was working one of an endless series of goofy jigsaw puzzles. This one was about 6,000 different cogs and gears on a plain white background. It would have driven me out of my skull in about 15 minutes. And he was playing his recorder in the living room. It didn't take long for me to start wishing I had skipped the cake and milk. Arnie told them what he had done, showed them the receipt, and they both promptly went through the roof. You have to understand that Michael and Regina were university people to the core. They were into doing good, and to them, that meant being into protest. They had protested in favor of integration in the early 60s, had moved on to Vietnam, and when that gave out, there was Nixon, questions of racial balance in the schools. They could quote you chapter and verse on the Allen Bakke case until you fell asleep, police brutality and parental brutality. Then there was the talk. All the talk. They were almost as much into talking as they were into protesting. They were ready to take part in an all-night bull session on the space program, or a teach-in on the ERA, or a seminar on possible alternatives to fossil fuels at the drop of an opinion. They had done time on God alone knew how many hotlines. Rape hotlines, drug hotlines, hotlines where runaway kids could talk to a friend, and good old dial help, where people thinking about suicide could call up and listen to a sympathetic voice say, "Don't do it, buddy. You have a social commitment to spaceship Earth." 20 or 30 years of university teaching, and you're prepared to run your gums the way Pavlov's dogs were prepared to salivate when the bell rang. I guess you can even get to like it. Regina, they insisted I call them by their first names, was 45 and handsome, in a rather cold, semi-aristocratic way. That is, she managed to look aristocratic even when she was wearing blue jeans, which was most of the time. Her field was English, but of course, when you teach at the college level, that's never enough. It's like saying America when someone asks you where you're from. She had it refined and calibrated like a blip on a radar screen. She specialized in the earlier English poets and had done her thesis on Robert Herrick. Michael was in the history biz. He looked as mournful and melancholy as the music he played on his recorder, although mournful and melancholy were not ordinarily a part of his makeup. Sometimes he made me think of what Ringo Starr was supposed to have said when the Beatles first came to America and some reporter at a press conference asked him if he was really as sad as he looked. "No," Ringo replied, "it's just me face." Michael was like that. Also, his thin face and the thick glasses he wore combined to make him look a little like a caricature professor in an unfriendly editorial cartoon. His hair was receding, and he wore a small, fuzzy goatee. "Hi, Arnie," Regina said as we came in. "Hello, Dennis." It was just about the last cheerful thing she said to either of us that afternoon. We said hi and got our cake and milk. We sat in the breakfast nook. Dinner was cooking in the oven, and I'm sorry to say so, but the aroma was fairly rank. Regina and Michael had been flirting with vegetarianism for some time, and tonight it smelled as if Regina had a good old kelp quiche or something on the way. I hoped they wouldn't invite me to stay. The recorder music stopped, and Michael wandered out into the kitchen. He was wearing blue jean cutoffs and looking as if his best friend had just died. "You're late, boys," he said. "Anything going down?" He opened the refrigerator and began to root around in it. Maybe the kelp quiche didn't smell so wonderful to him, either. "I bought a car," Arnie said, cutting himself another piece of cake. "You did what?" his mother cried at once from the other room. She got up too quickly, and there was a thud as her thighs connected solidly with the edge of the card table she did her jigsaws on. The thud was followed by the rapid patter of pieces falling to the floor. That was when I started to wish I had just gone home. Michael Cunningham had turned from the refrigerator to stare at his son, holding a Granny Smith apple in one hand and a carton of plain yogurt in the other. "You're kidding," he said. And for some absurd reason, I noticed for the first time that his goatee, which he had worn since 1970 or so, was showing quite a bit of gray. "Arnie, you're kidding, right? Say you're kidding." Regina came in, looking tall and semi-aristocratic and pretty damn mad. She took one close look at Arnie's face and knew he wasn't kidding. "You can't buy a car," she said. "What in the world are you talking about? You're only 17 years old." Arnie looked slowly from his father by the fridge to his mother in the doorway leading to the living room. There was a stubborn, hard expression on his face that I couldn't remember ever having seen there before. If he looked that way more often around school, I thought, the machine shop kids wouldn't be so apt to push him around. "Actually, you're wrong," he said. "I can buy it with no trouble at all. I couldn't finance it, but buying it for cash presents no problems. Of course, registering a car at 17 is something else entirely. For that, I need your permission." They were looking at him with surprise, uneasiness, and I saw this last and felt a sinking sensation in my belly, rising anger. For all their liberal thinking and their commitment to the farm workers and abused wives and unwed mothers and all the rest, they pretty much managed Arnie, and Arnie let himself be managed. "I don't think there's any call to talk to your mother that way," Michael said. He put back the yogurt, held on to the Granny Smith, and slowly closed the fridge door. "You're too young to have a car." "Dennis has one," Arnie said promptly. Say, wow, look how late it's getting, I said. I ought to be getting home. I ought to be getting home right away. What Dennis's parents choose to do and what your own choose to do are different things, Regina Cunningham said. I had never heard her voice so cold. Never. And you had no right to do such a thing without consulting your father and me about... Consult you? Arnie roared suddenly. He spilled his milk. There were big veins standing out on his neck in cords. Regina took a step backward, her jaw dropping. I would be willing to bet she had never been roared at by her ugly duckling son in her entire life. Michael looked just as flabbergasted. They were getting a taste of what I had already felt. For inexplicable reasons of his own, Arnie had finally happened on something he really wanted. And God help anyone who got in his way. Consult you! I've consulted you on every damn thing I've ever done. Everything was a committee meeting, and if it was something I didn't want to do, I got outvoted, 2-1. But this is no goddamn committee meeting. I bought a car, and that's it. It most certainly is not it, Regina said. Her lips had thinned down, and oddly, or perhaps not, she had stopped looking just semi-aristocratic. Now, she looked like the Queen of England or someplace, jeans and all. Michael was out of it for the time being. He looked every bit as bewildered and unhappy as I felt, and I knew an instant of sharp pity for the man. He couldn't even go home to dinner to get away from it. He was home. Here was a raw power struggle between the old guard and the young guard, and it was going to be decided the way those things almost always are, with a monstrous overkill of bitterness and acrimony. Regina was apparently ready for that, even if Michael wasn't. But I wanted no part of it. I got up and headed for the door.
You let him do this?
Regina asked. She looked at me haughtily, as if we'd never laughed together, or baked pies together, or gone on family campouts together. Dennis, I'm surprised at you. That stung me. I had always liked Arnie's mom well enough, but I had never completely trusted her. At least, not since something that had happened when I was 8 years old or so. Arnie and I had ridden our bikes downtown to take in a Saturday afternoon movie. On the way back, Arnie had fallen off his bike while swerving to avoid a dog and had jobbed his leg pretty good. I rode him home double on my bike, and Regina took him to the emergency room, where a doctor put in half a dozen stitches. And then, for some reason, after it was all over and it was clear that Arnie was going to be perfectly fine, Regina turned on me and gave me the rough side of her tongue. She read me out like a top sergeant. When she finished, I was shaking all over and nearly crying. What the hell, I was only 8, and there had been a lot of blood. I can't remember chapter and verse of that bawling out, but the overall feeling it left me with was disturbing. As best I remember, she started out by accusing me of not watching him closely enough, as if Arnie were much younger instead of almost exactly my own age, and ended up saying, or seeming to say, that it should have been me. This sounded like the same thing all over again. Dennis, you weren't watching him closely enough. And I got angry myself. My wariness of Regina was probably only part of it, and to be completely honest, probably only the small part. When you're a kid, and after all, what is 17 but the outermost limit of kidhood, you tend to be on the side of other kids. You know with a strong and unerring instinct that if you don't bulldoze down a few fences and knock some gates flat, your folks, out of the best intentions, would be happy to keep you in the kid corral forever. I got angry, but I held on to it as well as I could. I didn't let him do anything, I said. He wanted it, he bought it. Earlier, I might have told them he had done no more than lay down a deposit, but I wasn't going to do that now. Now, I had my backup. I tried to talk him out of it, in fact. I doubt if you tried very hard, Regina shot back. She might as well have come out and said, Don't bullshit me, Dennis. I know you were in it together. There was a flush on her high cheekbones, and her eyes were throwing off sparks. She was trying to make me feel 8 again, and not doing too bad a job. But I fought it. You know, if you got all the facts, you'd see this isn't much to get hot under the collar about. He bought it for $250, and... $250?! Michael broke in. What kind of car can you get for $250? His previous uncomfortable disassociation, if that's what it had been, and not just simple shock at the sound of his quiet son's voice raised in protest, was gone. It was the price of the car that had gotten to him, and he looked at his son with an open contempt that sickened me a little. I'd like to have kids myself someday, and if I do, I hope I can leave that particular expression out of my repertoire. I kept telling myself to just stay cool. It wasn't my affair or my fight, nothing to get hot under the collar about. But the cake I had eaten was sitting in the center of my stomach in a large, sticky glob, and my skin felt too hot. The Cunninghams had been my second family since I was a little kid, and I could feel all the distressing physical symptoms of a family quarrel inside myself. "You can learn a lot about cars when you're fixing up an old one," I said. I suddenly sounded like a loony imitation of LeBay to myself, and it'll take a lot of work before it's even street legal. If it ever is, I thought. You could look at it as a hobby. I look upon it as madness, Regina said. Suddenly I just wanted to get out. I suppose that if the emotional vibrations in the room hadn't been getting so heavy, I might have found it funny. I had somehow gotten into the position of defending Arnie's car when I thought the whole thing was preposterous to begin with. "Whatever you say," I muttered. "Just leave me out of it. I'm going home." "Good," Regina snapped. "That's it," Arnie said tonelessly. He stood up. "I'm getting the fuck out of here." Regina gasped, and Michael blinked as if he'd been slapped. "What did you say?" Regina managed. "What did you—" "I don't get what you're so upset about," Arnie told them in an eerie, controlled voice. "But I'm not going to stick around and listen to a lot of craziness from either of you. You wanted me in the college courses? I'm there." He looked at his mother. "You wanted me in the chess club instead of the school band? Okay. I'm there, too. I've managed to get through 17 years without embarrassing you in front of the bridge club or landing in jail." They were staring at him, wide-eyed, as if one of the kitchen walls had suddenly grown lips and started to talk. Arnie looked at them, his eyes odd and white and dangerous. "I'm telling you, I'm going to have this. This one thing."
"Arnie, the insurance," Michael began.
"Stop it!" Regina shouted. She didn't want to start talking about the specific problems because that was the first step on the road to possible acceptance. She simply wanted to crush the rebellion under her heel quickly and completely. There are moments when adults disgust you in ways they would never understand. I believe that, you know? I had one of those moments then, and it only made me feel worse. When Regina shouted at her husband, I saw her as both vulgar and scared. And because I loved her, I had never wanted to see her either way. Still, I remained in the doorway, wanting to leave but unhealthily fascinated by what was going on, the first full-scale argument in the Cunningham family that I had ever seen, maybe the first ever. And it surely was a wowzer, at least 10 on the Richter scale.
"Dennis, you'd better leave while we thrash this out," Regina said grimly.
"Yes," I said, "but don't you see, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. This car, Regina, Michael, if you could see it, it probably goes from 0 to 30 in 20 minutes, if it moves at all. Dennis, go!" I went. As I was getting into my duster, Arnie came out the back door, apparently meaning to make good on his threat to leave. His folks came after him, now looking worried as well as pissed off. I could understand a little bit how they felt. It had been as sudden as a cyclone touching down from a clear blue sky. I keyed the engine and backed out into the quiet street. A lot had surely happened since the two of us had punched out at 4 o'clock 2 hours ago. Then I had been hungry enough to eat almost anything, kelp quiche excepted. Now my stomach was so roiled I felt as if I would barf up anything I swallowed. When I left, the three of them were standing in the driveway in front of their two-car garage. Michael's Porsche and Regina's Volvo wagon were snuggled up inside. "They got their cars," I remember thinking, a little meanly. "What do they care?" Still arguing. "That's it," I thought, now feeling a little sad as well as upset. They'll beat him down, and LeBay will have his $25, and that 58 Plymouth will sit there for another 1,000 years or so. They had done similar things to him before, because he was a loser. Even his parents knew it. He was intelligent, and when you got past the shy and wary exterior, he was humorous and thoughtful and sweet, I guess is the word I'm fumbling around for. Sweet, but a loser. His folks knew it as well as the machine shop White Soxers, who yelled at him in the halls and thumb-rubbed his glasses. They knew he was a loser, and they would beat him down. That's what I thought. But that time, I was wrong. Chapter 3, The Morning After. I cruised by Arnie's house the next morning at 6:30 a.m. and just parked at the curb, not wanting to go in, even though his mother and father would still be in bed. There had been too many bad vibes flying around in that kitchen the evening before for me to feel comfortable about the usual donut and coffee before work. Arnie didn't come out for almost 5 minutes, and I started to wonder if maybe he hadn't made good on his threat to just take off. Then the back door opened, and he came down the driveway, his lunch bucket banging against one leg. He got in, slammed the door, and said, "Drive on, Jeeves!" This was one of Arnie's standard witticisms when he was in a good humor. I drove on, looked at him cautiously, almost decided to say something, and then decided I'd better wait for him to start, if he had anything to say at all. For a long time, it seemed that he didn't. We drove most of the way to work with no conversation between us at all, nothing but the sound of WMDY, the local rock and soul station. Arnie beat time absently against his leg. At last he said, "I'm sorry you had to be in on that last night, man." "That's okay, Arnie." "Has it ever occurred to you," he said abruptly, "that parents are nothing but overgrown kids until their children drag them into adulthood, usually kicking and screaming?" I shook my head. "Tell you what I think," he said. We were coming up on the construction site now. The Carson brothers' trailer was only 2 rises over. The traffic this early was light and somnolent. The sky was a sweet peach color. "I think that part of being a parent is trying to kill your kids." "That sounds very rational," I said. "Mine are always trying to kill me. Last night it was my mother sneaking in with a pillow and putting it over my face. Night before, it was Dad chasing my sister and me around with a screwdriver." I was kidding, but I wondered what Michael and Regina might think if they could hear this rap. "I know it sounds a little crazy at first," Arnie said, unperturbed, "but there are lots of things that sound nuts until you really consider them. Penis envy, Oedipal conflicts, the Shroud of Turin." "Sounds like horse shit to me," I said. "You had a fight with your folks, that's all." "I really believe it, though," Arnie said, pensively. "Not that they know what they're doing. I don't believe that at all. And do you know why?" "Do tell," I said. "Because as soon as you have a kid, you know for sure that you're going to die. When you have a kid, you see your own gravestone."
"You know what, Arnie?"
"What?"
"I think that's fucking gruesome," I said. And we both burst out laughing.
"I don't mean it that way," he said.
We pulled into the parking lot, and I turned off the engine. We sat there for a moment or two.
"I told him I'd opt out of the college courses," he said. "Told him I'd sign up for VT right across the board."
VT was vocational training, the same sort of thing the reform schoolboys get, except, of course, they don't go home at night. They have what you might call a compulsory live-in program.
"Arnie," I began, unsure of just how to go on. The way this thing had blown up out of nothing still freaked me out. "Arnie, you're still a minor. They have to sign your program."
"Sure, of course," Arnie said. He smiled at me humorlessly, and in that cold dawn light, he looked at once older and much, much younger, like a cynical baby somehow.
"They have the power to cancel my entire program for another year if they want to, and substitute their own. They could sign me up for Home Ec and World of Fashion if they wanted to. The law says they can do it."
but no law says they can make me pass what they pick.
That brought it home to me. The distance he had gone, I mean. How could that old clunker of a car have come to mean so much to him so damn fast? In the following days, that question kept coming at me in different ways, the way I've always imagined a fresh grief would. When Arnie told Michael and Regina he meant to have it, he sure hadn't been kidding. He had gone right to that place where their expectations for him lived the most strongly, and he had done it with a ruthless expediency that surprised me. I'm not sure that lesser tactics would have worked against Regina, but that Arnie had actually been able to do it surprised me. In fact, it surprised the shit out of me. What it boiled down to was if Arnie spent his senior year in VT, college went out the window. And to Michael and Regina, that was an impossibility. So they just gave up? It was close to punch-in time, but I couldn't let this go until I knew everything. Not just like that, no. I told them I'd find garage space for it, and that I wouldn't try to have it inspected or registered until I had their approval. Do you think you're going to get that? He flashed me a grim smile that was somehow both confident and scary. It was the smile of a bulldozer operator lowering the blade of a DC-9 cat in front of a particularly difficult stump. I'll get it, he said. When I'm ready, I'll get it. And you know what? I believed he would. Chapter 4. Arnie Gets Married. We could have had 2 hours of overtime that Friday evening, but we declined it. We picked up our checks in the office and drove down to the Libertyville branch of Pittsburgh Savings and Loan and cashed them. I dumped most of mine into my savings account, put 50 into my checking account. Just having one of those made me feel disquietingly adult. The feeling, I suppose, wears off. And held on to 20 in cash. Arnie drew all of his in cash. Here, he said, holding out a 10 spot. No, I said. You hang on to it, man. You'll need every penny of it before you're through with that clunk. Take it, he said. I pay my debts, Dennis. Keep it, really. Take it. He held the money out inexorably. I took it, but I made him take the dollar he had coming back. He didn't want to do that. Driving across town to LeBay's tract house, Arnie got more jittery, playing the radio too loud, beating boogie riffs first on his thighs and then on the dashboard. Foreigner came on, singing Dirty White Boy. Story of my life, Arnie, my man, I said, and he laughed, too loud and too long. He was acting like a man waiting for his wife to have a baby. At last, I guessed he was scared LeBay had sold the car out from under him. Arnie, I said, stay cool, it'll be there. I'm cool, he said, and offered me a large, glowing, false smile. His complexion that day was the worst I ever saw it, and I wondered, not for the first time or the last, what it must be like to be Arnie Cunningham, trapped behind that oozing face from second to second and minute to minute, and... Well, just stop sweating. You act like you're going to make lemonade in your pants before we get there. I'm not, he said, and beat another quick, nervous riff on the dashboard just to show me how nervous he wasn't. Dirty White Boy by Foreigner gave way to Jukebox Hero by Foreigner. It was Friday afternoon, and the block party weekend had started on FM 104. When I look back on that year, my senior year, it seems to me that I could measure it out in blocks of rock and an escalating, dreamlike sense of terror. What exactly is it? I asked. What is it about this car? He sat looking out at Libertyville Avenue without saying anything for a long time, and then he turned off the radio with a quick snap, cutting off Foreigner in mid-flight. I don't know exactly, he said. Maybe it's because, for the first time since I was 11 and started getting pimples, I've seen something even uglier than I am. Is that what you want me to say? Does that let you put it in a neat little category? Hey, Arnie, come on, I said. This is Dennis here, remember me?
I remember, he said.
And we're still friends, right?
Sure, last time I checked, but what has that got to do with...
And that means we don't have to lie to each other.
Or at least, I think that's what it's supposed to mean.
So, I gotta tell you, maybe it's not all jive. I know what I am. I'm ugly. I don't make friends easily. I alienate people somehow. I don't mean to do it, but somehow I do, you know?
I nodded with some reluctance. As he said, we were friends, and that meant keeping the bullshit to a bare minimum. He nodded back, matter-of-factly.
Other people, he said, and then added carefully, you, for instance, Stannis, don't always understand what that means. It changes how you look at the world when you're ugly and people laugh at you. It makes it hard to keep your sense of humor. It plugs up your sinuses. Sometimes it makes it a little hard to stay sane.
Well, I can dig that, but
no, he said quietly. You can't dig it. You might think you can, but you can't. Not really. But you like me, Dennis.
I love you, man, I said. You know that.
Maybe you do, he said. And I appreciate it. If you do, you know it's because there's something else. Something underneath the zits and my stupid face.
Your face isn't stupid, Arnie, I said. Queer-looking, maybe, but not stupid.
Fuck you, he said, smiling.
And a cayuse you rode in on, Range Rider.
Anyway, that car's like that. There's something underneath, something else, something better. I see it, that's all.
Do you?
Yeah, Dennis, he said quietly. I do.
I turned onto Main Street. We were getting close to LeBay's now. And suddenly I had a truly nasty idea. Suppose Arnie's father had gotten one of his friends or students to beat his feet over to LeBay's house and buy that car out from under his son. A touch Machiavellian, you might say, but Michael Cunningham's mind was more than a little devious. His specialty was military history.
I saw that car, and I felt such an attraction to it. I can't explain it very well, even to myself, but...
He trailed off, those gray eyes looking dreamily ahead.
But I saw I could make her better, he said.
Fix it up, you mean?
Yeah, well, no, that's too... impersonal. You fix tables, chairs, stuff like that. The lawnmower when it won't start, and ordinary cars.
Maybe he saw my eyebrows go up. He laughed, anyway, a little defensive laugh.
Yeah, I know how that sounds, he said. I don't even like to say it because I know how it sounds, but you're a friend, Dennis. And that means a minimum of bullshit. I don't think she's any ordinary car. I don't know why I think that, but I do.
I opened my mouth to say something I might later have regretted, something about trying to keep things in perspective, or maybe even about avoiding obsessive behavior. But just then we swung around the corner and onto LeBay's street. Arnie pulled air into his lungs in a harsh, hurt gasp. There was a rectangle of grass on LeBay's lawn. It was even yellower, balder, and uglier than the rest of his lawn. Near one end of that patch, there was a diseased-looking oil spill that had sunk into the ground and killed everything that had once grown there. That rectangular piece of ground was so fucking gross, I almost believe that if you looked at it for too long, you'd go blind. It was where the 1958 Plymouth had been standing on yesterday. The ground was still there, but the Plymouth was gone. Arnie, I said as I swung my car into the curb, take it easy, don't go off half-cocked, for Christ's sake.
He paid not a bit of attention. I doubt if he had even heard me. His face had gone pale. The blemishes covering it stood out in purplish, glaring relief. He had the passenger door of my Duster open and was lunging out of the car even before it had stopped moving. "Arnie! It's my father!" he said in anger and dismay. "I smell that bastard all over this!" And he was gone, running across the lawn to LeBay's door. I got out and hurried after him, thinking that this crazy shit was never going to end. I could hardly believe I had just heard Arnie Cunningham call Michael a bastard. Arnie was raising his fist to hammer on the door when it opened. There stood Roland D. LeBay himself. Today he was wearing a shirt over his back brace. He looked at Arnie's furious face with a benignly avaricious smile. "Hello, son," he said. "Where is she?" Arnie raged. "We had a deal. Damn it, we had a deal. I've got a receipt." "Simmer down," LeBay said. He saw me, standing on the bottom step with my hands shoved down in my pockets. "What's wrong with your friend, son?"
"The car's gone," I said. "That's what's wrong with him."
"Who bought it?" Arnie shouted. I'd never seen him so mad. If he had had a gun right then, I believe he would have put it to LeBay's temple. I was fascinated, in spite of myself. It was as if a rabbit had suddenly turned carnivore. God help me, I even wondered fleetingly if he might not have a brain tumor.
"Who bought it?" LeBay repeated mildly. "Well, nobody has yet, son. But you got a lien on her. I backed her into the garage, that's all. I put on a spare and changed the oil."
He preened, and then offered us both an absurdly magnanimous smile.
"You're a real sport," I said.
Arnie stared at him uncertainly, then turned his head creakily to look at the closed door of the modest one-car garage that was attached to the house by a breezeway. The breezeway, like everything else around LeBay's place, had seen better days.
"Besides, I didn't want to leave her out once you'd laid some money down on her," he said. "I've had some trouble with one or two of the folks on this street. One night some kid threw a rock at my car. Oh yeah, I got some neighbors straight out of the old A.B.
"What's that?" I asked.
"The asshole brigade, son."
He swept the far side of the street with a baleful sniper's glance, taking in the neat, gas-thrifty commuters' cars now home from work, the children playing tag and jump rope, the people sitting out on their porches and having drinks in the first of the evening cool.
"I'd like to know who it was through that rock," he said softly. "Yes, sir. I'd surely like to know who it was."
Arnie cleared his throat. "I'm sorry I gave you a hard time."
"Don't worry," LeBay said briskly. "I'd like to see a fella stand up for what's his, or what's almost his. You bring the money, kid?"
"Yes, I have it."
"Well, come on in the house. You and your friend both. I'll sign her over to you, and we'll have a glass of beer to celebrate."
"No, thanks," I said. "I'll stay out here, if that's okay."
"Suit yourself, son," LeBay said, and winked. To this day, I have no idea exactly what that wink was supposed to mean.
They went in, and the door banged shut behind them. The fish had been netted, and was about to be cleaned. Feeling depressed, I walked through the breezeway to the garage and tried the door. It ran up easily, and exhaled the same odors I had smelled when I opened the Plymouth's door yesterday. Oil, old upholstery, the accumulated heat of a long summer. Rakes and a few old garden implements were ranked along one wall. On the other was a very old hose, a bicycle pump, and an ancient golf bag filled with rusty clubs. In the center, nose outward, sat Arnie's car. Christine, looking a mile long in this day and age, when even Cadillacs looked squeezed together and boxy. The spiderweb snarl of cracks at the side of the windshield caught the light and turned it to a dull quicksilver. Some kid with a rock, as LeBay had said, or maybe a little accident coming home from the VFW hall after a night of drinking Boilermakers and telling stories about the Battle of the Bulge or Porkchop Hill. The good old days, when a man could see Europe, the Pacific, and the mysterious East from behind the sight of a bazooka. Who knew, and what did it matter? Either way,
It was not going to be easy finding a replacement for a big wrap windshield like that. Or cheap. Oh, Arnie, I thought. Man, you are getting in so deep. The flat LeBay had taken off rested against the wall. I got down on my hands and knees and peered under the car. A fresh oil stain was starting to form there, black against the brownish ghost of an older, wider stain that had sunk into the concrete over a period of years. It did nothing to alleviate my depression. The block was cracked, for sure. I walked around to the driver's side, and as I grasped the handle, I saw a waste can at the far corner of the garage. A large plastic bottle was poking out of the top. The letters S-A-P-P-H were visible over the rim. I groaned. Oh, he had changed the oil, all right. Big of him. He had run out of the old, whatever was left of it, and had run in a few quarts of sapphire motor oil. This is the stuff you can get for $3.50 per recycled 5-gallon jug at the Mammoth Mart. Roland D. LeBay was a real prince, all right. Roland D. LeBay was all heart. I opened the car door and slid in behind the wheel. Now the smell in the garage didn't seem quite so heavy or so freighted with feelings of disuse and defeat. The car's wheel was wide and red, a confident wheel. I looked at that amazing speedometer again, that speedometer, which was calibrated not to 70 or 80, but all the way up to 120 miles an hour. No kilometers and little red numbers underneath. When this babe had rolled off the assembly line, the idea of going metric had yet to occur to anyone in Washington. No big red 55 on the speedometer, either. Back then, gas went for $29.9 a gallon, maybe less if a price war happened to be going on in your town. The Arab oil embargoes and the double-nickel speed limit had still been 15 years away. The good old days, I thought, and had to smile a little. I fumbled down to the left side of the seat and found the little button console that would move the seat back and forth and up and down, if it still worked, that was. More power to you, to coin a crappy little pun. There was factory air that certainly wouldn't work, and cruise control, and a big push-button radio with lots of chrome, AM only, of course. In 1958, FM was mostly a blank wasteland. I put my hands on the wheel, and something happened. Even now, after much thought, I'm not sure exactly what it was. A vision, maybe, but if it was, it sure wasn't any big deal. It was just that, for a moment, the torn upholstery seemed to be gone. The seat covers were whole and smelling pleasantly of vinyl. Or maybe that smell was real leather. The worn places were gone from the steering wheel. The chrome winked pleasantly in the summer evening light falling through the garage door. "Let's go for a ride, big guy," Christine seemed to whisper in the hot summer silence of LeBay's garage. "Let's cruise." And for just a moment, it seemed that everything changed. That ugly snarl of cracks in the windshield was gone, or seemed to be. The little swatch of LeBay's lawn that I could see was not yellowed, balding, and crabgrassy, but a dark, rich, newly cut green. The sidewalk beyond it was freshly cemented, not a crack in sight. I saw, or thought I did, or dreamed I did, a 57 Cadillac motor by out front. That GM high stepper was a dark, minty green, not a speck of rust on her. Big gangster white wall tires and hubcaps as deeply reflective as mirrors. A Cadillac the size of a boat, and why not? Gas was almost as cheap as tap water. "Let's go for a ride, big guy. Let's cruise." Sure, why not? I could pull out and turn toward downtown, toward the old high school that was still standing. It wouldn't burn down for another 6 years, not until 1964. And I could turn on the radio and catch Chuck Berry singing Maybelline, or the Everlys doing Wake Up Little Susie, or maybe Robin Luke wailing Susie Darling. And then I got out of that car just about as fast as I could. The door opened with a rusty, hellish screech, and I cracked my elbow good on one of the garage walls. I pushed the door shut. I didn't really even want to touch it, to tell you the truth. And then just stood there, looking at the Plymouth, which, barring a miracle, would soon be my friend Arnie's. I rubbed my bruised crazy bone. My heart was beating too fast.
Nothing. No new chrome, no new upholstery. On the other hand, plenty of dents and rust. One headlamp missing. I hadn't noticed that the day before. The radio aerial crazily askew, and that dusty, dirty smell of age. I decided right then that I didn't like my friend Arnie's car. I walked out of the garage, glancing back constantly over my shoulder, and I don't know why, but I didn't like it behind my back. I know how stupid that must sound, but it was how I felt. And there it sat, with its dented, rusty grill, nothing sinister or even strange, just a very old Plymouth automobile with an inspection sticker that had gone invalid on June 1st, 1976, a long time ago. Arnie and LeBay were coming out of the house. Arnie had a white slip of paper in his hand. His bill of sale, I assumed. LeBay's hands were empty. He had already made the money disappear. "Hope you enjoy her," LeBay was saying. And for some reason I thought of a very old pimp huckstering a very young boy. I felt a surge of real disgust for him, him with his psoriasis of the skull and his sweaty back brace. "I think you will. In time." His slightly roomy eyes found mine, held there for a second, and then slipped back to Arnie. "In time," he repeated. "Yes, sir, I'm sure I will," Arnie said absently. He moved toward the garage like a sleepwalker and stood looking at his car. "Keys are in her," LeBay said. I'll have to have you take her along. You understand that, don't you?"
"Will she start?"
"Started for me yesterday evening," LeBay said, but his eyes shifted away toward the horizon. And then, in the tone of one who has washed his hands of the whole thing, "Your friend here will have a set of jumpers in his trunk, I reckon." Well, as a matter of fact, I did have a set of jumper cables in my trunk, but I didn't much like LeBay guessing it. I didn't like him guessing it because I sighed a little. Because I didn't want to be involved in Arnie's future relationship with the old clunker he had bought. But I could see myself getting dragged in, step by step. Arnie had dropped out of the conversation completely. He walked into the garage and got into the car. The evening sun was slanting strongly in now, and I saw the little puff of dust that went up when Arnie sat down, and I automatically brushed at the seat of my own pants. For a moment, he just sat there behind the wheel, hands gripping it loosely, and I felt a return of my unease. It was, in a way, as if the car had swallowed him. I told myself to stop it, that there was no damn reason for me to be acting like a goosy seventh-grade schoolgirl. Then Arnie bent forward a little. The engine began to turn over. I turned and shot LeBay an angry, accusatory glance, but he was studying the sky again, as if for rain. It wasn't going to start. No way it was going to start. My Duster was in pretty good shape, but the two I'd owned before it were clunkers, modified clunkers, neither was in the same class as Christine, and I'd become very familiar with that sound on cold winter mornings, that slow and tired cranking that meant the battery was scraping the bottom of the barrel. "Don't bother, Arnie," I said. "It's not going to fire up." He didn't even raise his head. He turned the key off and then turned it on again. The motor cranked with painful, dragging slowness. I walked over to LeBay. "You couldn't even leave it running long enough to build up a charge, could you?" I asked. LeBay glanced at me from his yellowing, rheumy eyes, said nothing, and then began checking the sky for rain again. "Or maybe it never started at all. Maybe you just got a couple of friends to come over and help you push it into the garage. If an old shit like you has any friends." He looked down at me.
"Son," he said, "you don't know everything. You ain't even dry behind the ears yet. When you've slogged your way through a couple of wars, like I have..."
I said deliberately, "Fuck your couple of wars," and walked toward the garage, where Arnie was still trying to start his car. Might as well try to drink the Atlantic dry with a straw, or ride a hot air balloon to Mars, I thought.
Pretty soon the last ohm and erg would be sucked out of that old corroded Sears battery, and then there would be nothing but that most dismal of all automotive sounds, most commonly heard on rainy back roads and deserted highways, the dull, sterile click of the solenoid, followed by an awful sound like a death rattle. I opened the driver's side door. "I'll get my cables," I said. He looked up. "I think she'll start for me," he said. I felt my lips stretch in a large, unconvincing grin. "Well, I'll get them just in case."
"Sure, if you want,"
he said absently. And then, in a voice almost too low to hear, he said,
"Come on, Christine. What do you say?"
In the same instant, that voice awoke in my head and spoke again. "Let's go for a ride, big guy. Let's cruise." And I shuddered. He turned the key again. What I expected was that dull solenoid click and death rattle. What I heard was the slow crank of the engine suddenly speeding up. The engine caught, ran briefly, then quit. Arnie turned the key again. The engine cranked over faster. There was a backfire that sounded as loud as a cherry bomb in the closed space of the garage. I jumped. Arnie didn't. He was lost in his own world. At this point, I would have cursed it a couple of times, just to help it along. "Come on, you whore," is always a good one. "Let's go, cocksucker," has its merits, and sometimes just a good, hearty shitfire will turn the trick. Most guys I know would do the same. I think it's just one of the things you pick up from your father. What your mother leaves you is mostly good, hard-headed, practical advice. If you cut your toenails twice a month, you won't get so many holes in your socks. Put that down, you don't know where it's been. Eat your carrots, they're good for you. But it's from your father that you get the magic, the talismans, the words of power. If the car won't start, curse it. And be sure you curse it female. If you went 7 generations back, you'd probably find one of your forebears cursing the goddamn bitch of a donkey that stopped in the middle of the toll bridge somewhere in Sussex or Prague. But Arnie didn't swear at it. He murmured under his breath, "Come on, doll. What do you say?" He turned the key. The engine kicked twice, backfired again, and then started up. It sounded horrible, as if maybe 4 of the 8 pistons had taken the day off, but he had it running. I can hardly believe it, but I didn't want to stand around and discuss it with him. The garage was rapidly filling up with blue smoke and fumes. I went outside. "That turned out all right after all, didn't it?" LeBay said. "And you don't have to risk your own precious battery," he spat. I couldn't think of anything to say. To tell you the truth, I felt a little embarrassed. The car came slowly out of the garage, looking so absurdly long that it made you want to laugh or cry or do something. I couldn't believe how long it looked. It was like an optical illusion, and Arnie looked very small behind the wheel. He rolled down the window and beckoned me over. We had to raise our voices to make ourselves heard clearly. That was another thing about Arnie's girl, Christine. She had an extremely loud and rumbling voice. She was going to have to be Midas-sized in a hurry. If there was anything left of the exhaust system to attach a muffler to, that was, besides a lot of rusty lace. Since Arnie sat down behind the wheel, the little accountant in the automobile section of my brain had totted up expenses of about $600, not including the cracked windshield. God knew how much that might cost to replace. "I'm taking her down to Darnell's," Arnie yelled. "His ad in the paper says I can park it in one of the back bays for $20 a week. "Arnie, 20 a week for one of those back bays is too much," I bellowed back. Here was more robbery of the young and innocent. Darnell's garage sat next door to a 4-acre automobile wasteland that went by the falsely cheerful name of Darnell's Used Auto Parts. I had been there a few times, once to buy a starter for my duster, once to get a rebuilt carb for the Mercury, which had been my first car. Will Darnell was a great fat pig of a man who drank a lot and smoked long, rank cigars, although he was reputed to have a bad asthmatic condition. He professed to hate almost every car-owning teenager in Libertyville, but that didn't keep him from catering to them and rooking them. "I know,"
Arnie yelled over the bellowing engine. But it's only for a week or two, until I find a cheaper place. I can't take it home like this, Dennis. My dad and mom would have a shit fit.
That was certainly true. I opened my mouth to say something else, maybe to beg him again to stop this madness before it got completely out of control. Then I shut my mouth again. The deal was done. Besides, I didn't want to compete with that bellowing muffler anymore, or stand there pulling a lot of evil fried carbon exhaust into my lungs.
All right, I said, I'll follow you.
Good deal, he said, grinning. I'm going by Walnut Street and Basin Drive. I want to stay off the main roads.
Okay.
Thanks, Dennis.
He dropped the hydromatic transmission into D again, and the Plymouth lurched forward 2 feet, and then almost stalled. Arnie goosed the accelerator a little, and Christine broke dirty wind. The Plymouth crept down LeBay's driveway to the street. When he pushed the brake, only one of the taillights flashed. My mental automotive accountant relentlessly rang up another $5. He hauled the wheel to the left and pulled out into the street. The remains of the muffler scraped rustily at the lowest point of the driveway. Arnie gave it more gas, and the car roared like a refugee from the demo derby at Philly Plains. Across the street, people leaned forward on their porches or came to their doors to see what was going on. Bellowing and snarling, Christine rolled up the street at about 10 miles an hour, sending out great stinking clouds of blue oil smoke that hung and then slowly raftered in the mellow August evening. At the stop sign 40 yards up, it stalled. A kid rode past the Hulk on his Raleigh, and his impudent, brassy shout drifted back to me.
Put it in a trash master, mister!
Arnie's closed fist popped out of the window. His middle finger went up as he flipped the kid the bird. Another first. I had never seen Arnie flip anyone the bird in my life. The starter whined, the motor sputtered, and caught. This time there was a whole rattling series of backfires. It was as if someone had just opened up with a machine gun on Laurel Drive, Libertyville, USA. I groaned. Someone would call the cops pretty soon, reporting a public nuisance, and they would grab Arnie for driving an unregistered, uninspected vehicle, and probably for the nuisance charge as well. That would not exactly ease the situation at home. There was one final echoing bang. It rolled down the street like the explosion of a mortar shell, and then the Plymouth turned left on Martin Street, which brought you to Walnut about a mile up. The westering sun turned its battered red body briefly to gold as it moved out of sight. I saw that Arnie had his elbow cocked out the window. I turned to LeBay, mad all over again, ready to give him some more hell. I tell you, I felt sick inside my heart. But what I saw stopped me cold. Roland D. LeBay was crying. It was horrible, and it was grotesque, and most of all, it was pitiable. When I was 9, we had a cat named Captain Beefheart, and he got hit by a UPS truck. We took him to the vets. My mom had to drive slow because she was crying, and it was hard for her to see, and I sat in the back with Captain Beefheart. He was in a box, and I kept telling him the vet would save him. It was going to be okay. But even a little 9-year-old dumbhead like me could see it was never going to be all right for Captain Beefheart again, because some of his guts were out, and there was blood coming out of his asshole, and there was shit in the box and on his fur, and he was dying. I tried to pet him, and he bit my hand, right in the sensitive webbing between the thumb and the first finger. The pain was bad. That terrible feeling of pity was worse. I had not felt anything like that since then. Not that I was complaining, you understand. I don't think people should have feelings like that often. You have a lot of feelings like that, and I guess they take you away to the funny farm to make baskets. LeBay was standing on his balding lawn, not far from the place where that big patch of oil had defoliated everything, and he had this great big old man snot rag out, and his head was down. Then he was wiping his eyes with it. The tears gleamed greasily on his cheeks, more like sweat than real tears. His Adam's apple went up and down.
I turned my head so I wouldn't have to look at him cry and happened to stare straight into his one-car garage. Before, it had seemed really full. The stuff along the walls, of course, but most of all, that huge old car with its double headlights and its wraparound windshield and its acre of hood. Now the stuff along the walls only served to accentuate the garage's essential emptiness. It gaped, like a toothless mouth. That was almost as bad as LeBay. But when I looked back, the old bastard had gotten himself under control, well, mostly. He had stopped leaking at the eyes, and he had stuffed the snot rag into the back pocket of his patented old man's pants. But his face was still bleak. Very bleak.
"Well, that's that," he said hoarsely. "I'm shut of her, sonny."
"Mr. LeBay," I said, "I only wish my friend could make the same statement. If you knew the trouble he was in over that rust bucket with his folks..."
"Get out of here," he said. "You sound like a goddamn sheep. Just bah, 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 that's all I hear coming out in your hole. I think your friend there knows more than you do. Go and see if he needs a hand."
I started down the lawn to my car. I didn't want to hang around LeBay a moment longer.
"Nothing but bah, bah, bah,"
he yelled shrewishly after me, making me think of that old song by the Youngbloods.
"You don't know half as much as you think you knew."
I got into my car and drove away. I glanced back once as I made the turn onto Martin Street and saw him standing there on his lawn, the sunlight gleaming on his bald head. As things turned out, he was right. I didn't know half as much as I thought I did.
Chapter 5. How We Got to Darnell's. I drove down Martin to Walnut and turned right toward Basin Drive. It didn't take long to catch up with Arnie. He was pulled into the curb, and Christine's trunk lid was up. An automobile jack so old that it almost looked as if it might once have been used for changing wheels on Conestoga wagons was leaning against the crooked back bumper. The right rear tire was flat. I pulled in behind him and had no more than gotten out when a young woman waddled down toward us from her house, skirting a pretty good collection of plastic fantastic that was planted on her lawn. 2 pink flamingos, 4 or 5 little stone ducks in a line behind a big stone mother duck, and a really good plastic wishing well with plastic flowers planted in the plastic bucket. She was in dire need of Weight Watchers.
"You can't leave that junk here," she said, around a mouthful of chewing gum. "You can't leave that junk parked in front of our house. I just hope you know that."
"Ma'am," Arnie said, "I had a flat tire is all. I'll get it out of here just as soon as..."
"You can't leave it there, and I hope you know that,"
she said with a maddening kind of circularity.
"My husband will be home pretty soon. He don't want no junk car in front of the house."
"It's not junk," Arnie said, and something in his tone made her back up a step.
"You don't want to take that tone of voice to me, sonny,"
this overweight bebop queen said haughtily.
"It don't take much to get my husband mad."
"Look," Arnie began, in the same dangerous, flat voice he had used when Michael and Regina began ganging up on him. I grabbed his shoulder hard. More hassle we didn't need.
"Thanks, ma'am," I said. "We'll get it taken care of right away. We're going to take care of it so quick you'll think you hallucinated this car."
"You better,"
she said, and then hooked a thumb at my duster.
"And your car's parked in front of my driveway."
I backed my duster up. She watched, and then joggled back up to her house, where a little boy and a little girl were crammed into the doorway. They were pretty porky, too. Each of them was eating a nice, nourishing devil dog.
"What's the matter, Ma?" the little boy asked. "What's the matter to that man's car, Ma? What's the matter?"
"Shut up," the bebop queen said, and hauled both kids back inside. I always like to see enlightened parents like that. It gives me hope for the future. I walked back to Arnie.
"Well," I said, dragging out the only witticism I could think of, "it's only flat on the bottom, Arnie, right?"
He smiled wanly.
"I got a slight problem, Dennis," he said.
I knew what his problem was. He had no spare. Arnie dragged out his wallet again. It hurt me to see him do it, and looked inside.
I gotta get a new tire, he said.
Yeah, I guess you do. A retread.
No retreads. I don't want to start out that way.
I didn't say anything, but I glanced back toward my duster. I had two retreads on it, and I thought they were just fine.
How much do you think a new Goodyear Firestone would cost, Dennis?
I shrugged and consulted the little automotive accountant, who guessed that Arnie could probably get a new no-frills black wall for around $35. He pulled out two 20s and handed them to me.
If it's more with the tax and everything, I'll pay you back.
I looked at him sadly. Arnie, how much of your week's pay you got left? His eyes narrowed and shifted away from mine.
Enough, he said.
I decided to try one more time. You must remember that I was only 17 and still under the impression that people could be shown where their best interest lay. You couldn't get into a nickel poker game, I said. You plug just about the whole fucking wad into that car. Dragging out your wallet is going to become a very familiar action to you, Arnie. Please, man. Think it over. His eyes went flinty. It was an expression I had not seen before on his face, and although you'll probably think I was the most naive teenager in America, I couldn't really remember having seen it on any face before. I felt a mixture of surprise and dismay. I felt the way I might have felt if I suddenly discovered I was trying to have a rational conversation with a fellow who just happened to be a lunatic. I have seen the expression since, though. I imagine you have, too. Total shutdown. It's the expression a man gets on his face when you tell him the woman he loves is whoring around behind his back.
Don't get going on that, Dennis, he said.
I threw my hands up in exasperation.
All right, all right. And you don't have to go after the damn tire either if you don't want to.
That flinty, obdurate, and so help me, it's true, stupidly stubborn expression was still on his face.
I'll find a way.
I started to reply, and I might have said something pretty hot, but then I happened to glance to my left. The two porky little kids were there at the edge of their lawn. They were astride identical big wheels, their fingers smeared with chocolate. They were watching us, solemnly.
No big deal, man, I said. I'll get the tire.
Only if you want to, Dennis, he said. I know it's getting late.
It's cool, I said.
Mister, the little boy said, licking chocolate off his fingers.
What?
Arnie asked.
My mother says that car's poopy.
That's right,
the little girl chimed.
Poopy caca.
Poopy caca, Arnie said.
Well, that's very perceptive, isn't it, kids?
Is your mother a philosopher?
No, the little boy said. She's Capricorn. I'm a Libra. My sister's a...
I'll be back as quick as I can, I said awkwardly.
Sure.
Stay cool.
Don't worry. I'm not about to punch anybody.
I trotted to my car. As I slipped behind the wheel, I heard the little girl ask Arnie loudly,
Why's your face all messy like that, mister?
I drove a mile and a half down to JFK Drive, which, according to my mother, who grew up in Libertyville, used to be at the center of one of the town's most desirable neighborhoods, back around the time Kennedy was killed in Dallas. Maybe renaming Barnswallow Drive for the slain president had been bad luck, because since the early 60s, the neighborhood around the street had degenerated into an ex-urban strip. There was a drive-in movie, a McDonald's, a Burger King, an Arby's, and the Big 20 Lanes. There were also 8 or 10 service stations, since JFK Drive leads to the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Getting Arnie's tire should have gone lickety-split, but the first two stations I came to were those self-service jobbies that don't even sell oil. There's just gas and a marginally retarded girl in a booth made of bulletproof glass, who sits in front of a computer console reading a National Enquirer and chewing a wad of Bubblicious gum big enough to choke a Missouri mule. The third one was a Texaco having a tire sale. I was able to buy Arnie a black wall that would fit his Plymouth. I could not bring myself then to call her Christine or even think of her, it, by that name, for just $28.50 plus tax. But there was only one guy working there, and he had to put the new tire on Arnie's wheel rim and pump gas at the same time. The operation stretched out over 45 minutes. I offered to pump gas for the guy while he did it, but he said the boss would shoot him if he heard of it.
By the time I had the mounted tire back in my trunk and had paid the guy $2 for the job, the early evening light had become the fading purple of late evening. The shadow of each bush was long and velvety, and as I cruised slowly back up the street, I saw the day's last light streaming almost horizontally through the trash-littered space between the Arby's and the bowling alley. That light, so much flooding gold, was nearly terrible in its strange, unexpected beauty. I was surprised by a choking panic that climbed up in my throat like dry fire. It was the first time a feeling like that had come over me that year, that long, strange year. But not the last. Yet it's hard for me to explain or even define. It had something to do with realizing that it was August 11th, 1978, that I was going to be a senior in high school next month. And that when school started again, it meant the end of a long, quiet phase of my life. I was getting ready to be a grown-up, and I saw that somehow, saw it for sure, for the first time, in that lovely but somehow ancient spill of golden light flooding down the alleyway between a bowling alley and a roast beef joint. And I think I understood then that what really scares people about growing up is that you stop trying on the life mask and start trying on another one. If being a kid is about learning how to live, then being a grown-up is about learning how to die. The feeling passed, but in its wake I felt shaken and melancholy. Neither state was much like my usual self. When I turned back onto Basin Drive, I was feeling suddenly removed from Arnie's problems and trying to cope with my own. Thoughts of growing up had led naturally to such gigantic, at least they seemed gigantic to me, and rather unpleasant ideas as college, and living away from home, and trying to make the football team at state with 60 other qualified people competing for my position instead of only 10 or 12. So maybe you're saying, big deal, Dennis, I got some news for you. 1 billion red Chinese don't give a shit if you make the first squad as a college freshman. Fair enough. I'm just trying to say that those things seemed really real to me for the first time, and really frightening. Your mind takes you on trips like that sometimes, and if you don't want to go, it takes you anyway. Seeing that the Bebop Queen's husband had indeed arrived home, and that he and Arnie were standing almost nose to nose, apparently ready to start mixing it up at any second, didn't help my mood at all. The two little kids still sat solemnly astride their big wheels, their eyes shifting back and forth from Arnie to Daddy and back again to Arnie, like spectators at some apocalyptic tennis match where the ref would cheerfully shoot the loser. They seemed to be waiting for the moment of combustion, when Daddy would flatten my skinny friend and do the cool jerk all the way up and down his broken body. I pulled over quickly and got out, almost running over to them.
"I'm done talking at your face!" Dad's bellowed. "I'm telling you I want it out, and I want it out right now."
He had a big, flattened nose full of burst veins. His cheeks were flushed to the color of new brick, and above his gray twill work shirt, corded veins stood out on his neck.
"I'm not going to drive it on the rim," Arnie said. "I told you that. You wouldn't do it if it was yours."
"I'll drive you on the rim, pizza face," Daddy said,
apparently intent on showing his children how big people solve their problems in the real world.
"You ain't parking your cruddy hot rod in front of my house. Don't you aggravate me, kiddo, or you're gonna get hurt."
"Nobody's gonna get hurt," I said. "Come on, mister, give us a break." Arnie's eyes shifted gratefully to me, and I saw how scared he had been, how scared he still was. Always and out, he knew there was something about him, God knew what, that made a certain type of guy want to pound the living shit out of him. He must have been pretty well convinced it was going to happen again. But this time he wasn't backing down. The man's eyes shifted to me.
"Another one," he said, as if marveling that there could be so many assholes in the world. "You want me to take you both on? Is that what you want? Believe me, I can do it."
Yes, I knew the type. 10 years younger, and he would have been one of the guys at school who thought it was terribly amusing to slam Arnie's books out of his arms when he was on his way to class, or to throw him into the shower with all his clothes on after phys ed. They never change, those guys. They just get older and develop lung cancer from smoking too many Luckies, or step out with a brain embolism at 53 or so.
"We don't want to take you on," I said. "He had a flat tire, for God's sake. Didn't you ever have a flat?"
Ralph, I want them out of here.
The porky wife was standing on the porch. Her voice was high and excited. This was better than the Phil Donahue show. Other neighbors had come out to watch developments, and I thought again with great weariness that if someone had not called the cops already, someone soon would.
I never had a flat and left some old piece of junk sit in front of someone's house for 3 hours,
Ralph said loudly. His lips were pulled back, and I could see spit shining on his teeth in the light of the setting sun. It's been an hour, I said quietly. If that.
Don't give me any of your smart mouth, kid, Ralph said. I ain't interested. I ain't like you guys. I work for a living. I come home tired. I ain't got time to argue. I want it out, and I want it out now.
I've got a spare right in my trunk, I said. If we could just put it on.
And if you had any common decency, Arnie began hotly.
That almost did it. If there was one thing our buddy Ralph wasn't going to have impugned in front of his kids, it was his common decency. He swung on Arnie. I don't know how it would have ended, with Arnie in jail, maybe, his precious car impounded, but somehow I was able to get my own hand up and catch Ralph's hand by the wrist. The two of them coming together made a flat smacking sound in the dusk. The porky little girl burst into whiny tears. The porky little boy sat astride his big wheel with his lower jaw hanging almost to his chest. Arnie, who had always scuttered past the smoking area at school like a hunted thing, never even flinched. He actually seemed to want it to happen. Ralph whirled on me, his eyes bulging with fury.
All right, you little shit, he said. You first.
I held onto his hand, straining.
Come on, man, I said in a low voice. The tire's in my trunk. Give us 5 minutes to change it and get out of your face, please.
Little by little, the pressure of holding his hand back slacked off. He glanced at his kids, the little girl sniveling, the little boy wide-eyed, and that seemed to decide him.
5 minutes, he agreed.
He looked at Arnie.
You're just goddamn lucky I ain't calling the police on you. That thing's uninspected, and it ain't got no tags either.
I waited for Arnie to say something else inflammatory and send the game into extra innings, but maybe he hadn't forgotten everything he knew about discretion.
Thank you, he said. I'm sorry if I got hot under the collar.
Ralph grunted and tucked his shirt back into his pants with savage little jabs. He looked over at his kids again.
Get in the house, he roared. What are you doing out here? You want me to put a bang-shang-a-lang on you?
Oh, God, what an onomatopoeic family, I thought. For Christ's sake, don't put a bang-shang-a-lang on them, Pops. They might make a poopy caca in their pants. The kids fled to their mother, leaving their big wheels behind.
5 minutes,
he repeated, looking at us balefully. And later tonight, when he was hoisting a few with the boys, he would be able to tell them how he had done his part to hold the line against the drugs and sex generation. Yes, sir, boys, I told him to get that fucking junk away from my house before I put a bang-shang-a-lang on him, and you want to believe they moved like their feet was on fire and their asses were catching. And then he would light up a Lucky. Or a Camel. We put Arnie's jack under the bumper. Arnie hadn't pumped the lever more than 3 times when the jack snapped in two. It made a dusty sound when it went, and rust puffed up. Arnie looked at me, his eyes at once humble and stricken. Never mind, I said. We'll use mine. It was twilight now, starting to get dark. My heart was still beating too fast, and my mouth was sour from the confrontation with the big cheese of 119 Basin Drive.
I'm sorry, Dennis, he said in a low voice. I won't get you involved with any of this again.
Forget it. Let's just get the tire on. We used my jack to get the Plymouth up. For several horrible seconds, I thought the rear bumper was just going to rip off in a screech of decaying metal, and pulled the dead tire. We got the new one on, tightened the lug nuts some, and then let it down. It was a great relief to have the car standing on the street again. The way that rotted bumper bent up under the jack had scared me.
There, Arnie said, clapping the ancient dented hubcap back on over the lug nuts.
I stood looking at the Plymouth, and the feeling I'd had in LeBay's garage suddenly recurred. It was looking at the fresh new Firestone on the right rear that did it. The black wall still had one of the manufacturer's stickers on it, and the bright yellow chalk marks from the gas jockey's hurried wheel balancing. I shivered a little, but to convey the sudden weirdness I felt would be
impossible. It was as if I had seen a snake that was almost ready to shed its old skin, that some of that old skin had already flaked away, revealing the glistening newness underneath. Ralph was standing on his porch, glowering down at us. In one hand, he was holding a drippy hamburger sandwich on Wonder Bread. His other hand was fisted around a can of Iron City.
"Handsome, ain't he?" I muttered to Arnie as I slung his busted jack into the Plymouth's trunk.
"A regular Robert Deadford,"
Arnie muttered back. And that was it. We both got the giggles, the way you sometimes will at the end of a long and tense situation. Arnie threw the flat into the trunk on top of the jack and then got snorting and holding his hands over his mouth. He looked like a kid who just got caught raiding the jam jar, thinking that made me break up all the way.
"What are you two punks laughing at?" Ralph roared. He came to the steps of his porch. "Huh? You want to try laughing on the other sides of your faces for a while? I can show you how, believe me."
"Get out of here quick," I said to Arnie and bolted back to my duster. Nothing could stop the laughter now. It just came rolling out. I fell into the front seat and keyed the engine, whinnying with laughter. In front of me, Arnie's Plymouth started up with a bellowing roar and a huge, stinking cloud of blue exhaust. Even over it, I could hear his high, helpless laughter, a sound that was close to hysteria. Ralph came charging across his lawn, still holding his drippy burger in his beer.
"What are you laughing at, you punks? Huh? You nerd!" Arnie shouted triumphantly and pulled out with a rattling fusillade of backfires.
I tromped the gas pedal of my own car and had to swerve to avoid Ralph, who was now apparently intent on murder. I was still laughing, but it wasn't good laughter anymore, if it ever had been. It was a shrill, breathless sound, almost like screaming.
"I'll kill you, punk!" Ralph roared.
I goosed the accelerator again, and this time I almost tailgated Arnie. I flipped Ralph the old Alberto.
"Jam it!" I yelled.
Then he was behind us. He tried to catch up. For a few seconds he came pounding along the sidewalk, and then he stopped, breathing hard and snarling.
"What a crazy day!"
I said aloud, a little frightened by the shaky, teary quality of my own voice. That sour taste was back in my mouth.
"What a crazy fucking day!"
Darnell's garage on Hampton Street was a long building with rusty corrugated tin sides and a rusty corrugated tin roof. Out front was a grease-caked sign which read, "Save money, your know-how, our tools." Below that was another sign in smaller type reading, "Garage space rented by the week, month, or year." The automobile junkyard was behind Darnell's. It was a block-long space enclosed in 5-foot-high strips of the same corrugated tin. Will Darnell's apathetic nod toward the town zoning board. Not that there was any way the board was going to bring Will Darnell to heel, and not just because two of the three zoning board members were his friends. In Libertyville, Will Darnell knew just about everyone who counted. He was one of those fellas you find in almost any large town or small city, moving quietly behind any number of scenes. I had heard that he was mixed up in the lively drug traffic at Libertyville High and Darby Junior High. I had also heard that he was on a nodding acquaintance with the big-time crooks in Pittsburgh and Philly. I didn't believe that stuff, at least, I didn't think I did. But I knew that if you wanted firecrackers or cherry bombs or bottle rockets for the 4th of July, Will Darnell would sell them to you. I had also heard from my father that Will had been indicted 12 years before, when I was but a lad of 5, as one of the kingpins in a stolen car ring that stretched from our part of the world east to New York City and all the way up to Bangor, Maine. Eventually, the charges were dropped, but my dad also said he was pretty sure that Will Darnell might be up to his ears in other shenanigans, anything from truck hijacking to fake antiques. "A good place to stay away from, Dennis," my father had said. This had been a year ago, not long after I got my first clunker and had invested $20 in renting one of Darnell's do-it-yourself garage bays to try and replace the carburetor, an experiment that had ended in dismal failure. A good place to stay away from. And here I was, pulling in through the main gates behind my friend Arnie after dark, nothing left of the day but a tinge of furnace red to the horizon. My headlights picked out enough discarded auto parts, wreckage, and general all-around dreck to make me feel more depressed and tired than ever.
I realized I hadn't called home, and that my mother and father would probably be wondering just where the hell I was. Arnie drove up to a big garage door with a sign beside it reading, "Honk for Entry." There was a feeble light spilling out through a grime-coated window beside the door. Somebody was at home, and I barely restrained an impulse to lean out of my window and tell Arnie to drive his car over to my house for the night. I had a vision of us stumbling onto Will Darnell and his cronies inventorying hijacked color TVs or repainting stolen Cadillacs. The Hardy Boys come to Libertyville. Arnie just sat there, not honking, not doing anything, and I was about to get out and ask him what was what when he came back to where I was parked. Even in the last of the failing light, he looked deeply embarrassed.
"Would you mind honking your horn for me, Dennis?" he said humbly.
"Christine's done seem to work."
"Sure. Thanks."
I beeped my horn twice, and after a pause, the big garage door went rattling up. Will Darnell himself.